Jay, welcome. Glad you're here. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to come down here in the podcast studio. It's your first time here?
Yes.
It used all to, set up.
It used to be a conference room.
It did so used to be a conference
room. It's much nicer as a podcast studio.
It's got dual function, so we use it for this, and we still have meetings down here. So as CEO of Cumberland Heights, which I think most people that are going to be watching or listening to this episode know that you're our CEO. You've been CEO for 7 years, I think, going on eight.
Eight going on nine, but who's counting?
Eight going on nine. What does a CEO do? What exactly do you do? Not much.
That's not the first time I've been asked that question.
Right.
Yeah, sometimes I say not much, but it's different from day to day. There's no standard. What does a normal day look like? I'll say a normal week has too many meetings in it, but it varies by day to day. So sometimes I'm meeting with potential donors or donors out on the campus on a tour. Some days I'm visiting one of our other locations. Some days I am looking at a piece of property on Zillow that the CFO doesn't mm-hmm. want me to buy.
Right.
A lot of interaction with board members, all the stakeholders at Cumberland Heights.
And your leadership team?
Yeah. Leadership team has regular standing meetings with me, each one every week for the most part. And then we collectively meet for a couple of hours every Tuesday. And so that's a lot of it. And many of us are located close to each other, so there's a lot of hallway conversations that happen to as things come up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just one of the things I point out when I think about your role, as I think about that I have a few different teams, but you have all the different teams, and how some people might not think about within any given day you might be meeting with clinical leaders like Cindy Stewart Freeman or Randall Lee, and then transition to Joey Darby and thinking about admissions, and then transitioning to Robin and thinking about finance and operations. And those are different parts of your brain sometimes. And that is, I see how full your schedule is and how you're hopping from one thing to the next, and that can be a challenge.
Can be. It's also an opportunity too. So I didn't start as the CEO here, and so I have a lot of job variety in my day. So I'm not doing the same thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do get to see the big picture. You know, part of my job sometimes is connecting one of the leadership team members with another leadership team member.
Right.
Because there's three things going on and they're interrelated. But, you know, because I've met with each one of them, it's like, okay, I need to bridge this gap somehow and mm-hmm. and connect and say, you want to go talk to Nick Hayes about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it too.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of your time at Cumberland Heights, I'm not going to tell your story for you, but how long have you been here, and where did you start?
Well, go ahead. You can tell my story. It'd be
interesting. Well, I'm curious if you're going to tell the truth or if you're going to polish it.
I always am authentic. And so it depends on where – everybody has their different favorite version of where I started.
My favorite version of where you started is, which we were talking about before, the dead plant behind me.
Okay.
Because I think that's truly the first outside of another part of your story.
Right.
Kind of the first professional introduction.
Yes. So I'll start at the beginning. I started here as a patient.
Mm.
So that's how I came to know Cumberland Heights. I got sober here in June of 1989 and was very active in the alumni, went to aftercare regularly, crossover on Friday nights, did all that, helped me to change the trajectory of my life. And as one of the guys in my aftercare group said, nobody gets here at the end of the winning streak, and that certainly was true for me, you know.
So. And how old were you? Can't remember.
26.
Yeah.
So that gave me a great opportunity to start my recovery and continue it outside of here, that alumni community. I would see them all over Nashville at meetings, et cetera. So I loved Cumberland Heights, saved my life. And, you know, about 4 years sober, I talked to actually a guy that was in my group in treatment that was working here, and I said, let me know if a job opens up. So I think what you're alluding to is at the time that I talked to Tom, My job was to water plants and office buildings for Priscilla's Plants, and Cumberland Heights was on my route for Thursday.
Priscilla's Plants, which was downtown Nashville way back in the day, correct?
Well, that's actually a botanical warehouse, so close. You don't like being corrected, do you?
No.
So I sold plants. Yeah, anyway, my counselor said, get a job, not a career. Focus on, you know, getting your life around.
Right.
But there was really not a lot of future in that. And so I realized that. And so I was looking for an opportunity. At the time, Cumberland Heights had a whopping 100 employees. So I thought, hey, there would be an opportunity maybe to start over. Cumberland Heights, one of the things I like to say about Cumberland Heights is a place of new beginnings and second chances. And for me, it was both. Right. So I had new beginning for a life of recovery, relationships with family and others. But I got a second chance in my employment career, too. And so I took an entry level job as an admissions assistant.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there was four of us in admissions. There was two admissions counselors, me, who did all the insurance benefits, paperwork, blah, 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 and a financial advisor. And you know, and I love that. To this day, I still love the admissions process. I've told people, like, when I retire, they probably want me to try to do fundraising, but I'd really love to just go sit in the intake center and answer phone calls.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the old intake center here was in the same building it is today, but tucked in the back where the financial advisors currently work?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've been here for a long time, and it's to see the different uses of the building. So where the financial advisors now, the four of us were there.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, that was the lounge for the women. So mm-hmm. the women were in what's now called Grace Place, which houses men, but that was their lounge. And so medical records was actually over there where Jill's office is. Mm. So it's changed, you know. You can do a lot with drywall and paint. So.
Well, yeah, and the parking lot was the courtyard, and there was this building wasn't here. And
correct.
Hazel Hawkins wasn't here.
No.
We might actually throw some pictures up online, but there was mobile units too, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
At one time?
Modular units. So my office modular moved from units. Time to time. You know, I was in that spot in admissions, but then I was actually forced to take a job that I didn't want to do, and I was downstairs where the current accounts receivable team is. That's where my office was.
Yep.
Then they moved us out to a modular unit, which was there for a while, and then they moved us into like what I call a double-double wide or a four wide that a bunch of us were in for a long time. And then they moved us back in to an office after a while.
Yeah.
So.
And by that time, I think, were you managing or completely running from a director's role, the admissions department?
So I went from the admissions assistant, which I did for about a year. My mentor, Tim Tull, CFO mm-hmm. at the time, wanted me in another role. The self-pay collector. This is the people that call people about their copays after. And, you know, that is not a job that I wanted to do. I tried not to do that job. He more or less said, well, your job's kind of going away, so, you know, you might want to reconsider that. So I did it. But I took to that. I did it as good as I could. There was a lot of opportunity for improvement. It's not a job I could have done for 5 years. There are people that are really good at that.
It's a really difficult job.
It is.
It's not a shiny, bright out in front. It's
no
often on the backside of treatment, calling people and saying, how can we work this out?
Yeah, make a payment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and our goal at that time, just as it is today, is to be fair and work with people if they're working with us. So there was, you know, I could find some peace with that. I wasn't trying to make people do something they couldn't do. But it was fortuitous because that job led to me learning about another part of the organization on the business side. And I'd had an undergraduate degree in business management. So I was a little bit more in the business side. We had a long time director of insurance. Or not director, we were managers or coordinators. But she left. She'd been here like 10 years. So I got an opportunity to take that job. So I learned more about insurance.
Like then, negotiating?
No, this was actually like calling insurance, getting stuff, call patients, calling insurance, you know, that
benefits,
sort of things.
Yep.
billing, all of that. And then the business office manager, that was her title. She too had been here for like 10 years. So a couple of years later, she left. I had an opportunity to take that. So really, opportunities arose for me. I had an opportunity to prove myself in my current position and move up and advance in the organizations. And, you know, what worked for me is what I tell people in new employee orientation is like always do more than what your job requires. And that was easy for me because I loved Cumberland Heights. And mm-hmm. so, and I sort of had a business mind. So I would always do things more. That got me noticed. And so that's when opportunities were there. I was like, well, you know, let's see if Jay could do that. So,
and was it Tim that came to you at some point in your career and told you that it'd be a good idea to get an MBA, or was it somebody else?
It was actually somebody else. So we had a consultant that came through.
Right.
And he asked me why I had not gone and gotten my master's degree. And I remember at early 30s thinking, you know, maybe I ought to go do that. And at the time, my thinking was, Cumberland Heights doesn't need that. They wouldn't pay me if I had that. You know, really, if I go do that, it's making a decision to, like, go work for HCA, you know. And, yeah. But I love Cumberland Heights. That was wrong thinking or very short-sighted. But he encouraged me to go back. And then not too long after that, Tim went back. He was actually a pharmacist by training, had worked in the hospital system, and was the CFO. And he went back to school to become a lawyer. So that was like, all right, I need to do it now, you know, if I'm going to be eligible. And as it turned out, his timing messed me up a little bit because he resigned from his CFO spot before he had his law degree, which I was timed to sort of finish at the same time. And so they actually hired a different CFO.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that was, you know, but I had decided, you know, I love Cumberland Heights. I'll just do my best. I tried to support him. He didn't fit here very good culturally.
Mm, yeah.
He wasn't a bad CFO. Probably. I mean, he was accomplished. But the culture here was a little different. And so a lot of things that were maybe right, he wasn't able to present them in a way that people could hear them. And then in July of 2010... we lost the Blue Cross contract. He was on vacation. He actually didn't get a call from the CEO about that, which was sort of a little telltale sign that he should have mm-hmm. gotten a call.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the month, he had found an opportunity to go into business for himself. So actually Robin and I sort of ran the finances of this place for 6 months.
I've got a cool story about that time.
Do you?
Because that's a really... I think folks that are here, that have been here for a couple of years, either they were there when that happened or they hear stories about, you know, just quote unquote, how difficult of a time that was for the organization
yeah.
for to lose, you know, our contract
mm-hmm.
with our largest payer partner.
Correct.
Which is a big deal.
It was.
And very turbulent. But somebody who worked here at the time, who I'll leave anonymous, told me a story about they were a therapist and that they remember it the same way. Some of the executive leadership was absent, not present,
mm-hmm.
No fault of their own. They were on vacation, what have you. And that you and maybe some others called an all-hands-on meeting kind of discussion about what we were going to do. Because we have current patients at that time
right.
when you got the notice that
right.
are hoping to use their benefits associated
right.
with this contract that we no longer have. And of course, the insurance company's not going to pay out those claims if we submit them. And one of the things that this therapist said that I think is just really cool about you is that your statement to the group and to the team and to the organization is that we were going to do everything that we could to honor the commitment that we had made to the patients that were currently here. We were going to make it right,
yeah.
essentially. Like, hey, if you can pay, you know, this is what that will be. But if you can't, you know, essentially we'll cover that cost.
I do remember that. Cindy Stewart Freeman was in there with me
mm-hmm.
that day. And we had talked. And you're right, there were two of the leadership team that were up in Minnesota. And then the other was on vacation. And we had been told to discharge all of the Blue Cross patients and send them to another facility. And so the decision that we made, and I give
told by the payer.
By the payer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you are.
Right.
You know, utilization review, you got a phone call. It's like everybody's got to go somewhere else.
Right.
Basically, what we told them is that, you know, we wanted to do right by the patient. If the patient wanted to stay, they wouldn't owe any more than they would have owed had their insurance company had paid their full claim. If they wanted to go, they could. And it was kind of interesting because we didn't ask Blue Cross could we do it. We just sort of told them this is what we had done. And a good number of them wanted to complete their treatment. They'd bonded with their counselor.
Of course.
I think out of the whole population that we had two or three that left.
Wow.
Everybody else stayed. But, you know, it was we just did the right thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think it's an interesting story, maybe a side of people that they didn't have because I was a finance guy or whatever, that they wouldn't expect that coming from us. But it is very much part of the DNA of Come On Heights to always, you know, do right by the patient. And, you know, those things will work themselves out.
That's one of the things I love about Cumberland Heights, and not to kind of toot our own horn on, you know, a show brought to you by Cumberland Heights and all that. But, you know, it's important to recognize that we're a not-for-profit and how that situates us in terms of our focus,
right,
which is not to a shareholder group or to an ownership group. It's to the patients and the communities that we serve. And so I think it's just shout out to you, right? But I think it's also just a microcosm, like you said, of the spirit of this place, which is absolutely unique in today's treatment world, if you will. Something else, another observation about you that I think is cool is your experience. In some ways, what makes you a great CEO, which is a lot of things, relax, you
thanks.
Know.
Thanks. It's not even time for your annual evaluation.
is that you have had lots of experiences in what I would call is systems-heavy departments throughout this healthcare organization, you know? And so you're right. I do find when I'm having when we're meeting about something or I'm updating you about a big project, oftentimes you'll remind me to make sure that I'm bringing other people along with our teams and that we're collaborating and that we don't do things in isolation and that in the absence of information, a narrative might get created. And I think that speaks to, you know, the finance departments or admissions or UR or have always been a part of every part of treatment, you know, and that's a unique skill set that maybe a, you know, clinical only experienced individual might not have, you know. Have you ever thought about that, that unique skill set that you have brought based on your experience?
Not the way you described it, but I think it's also from having been here for a long time.
You
so I think other people have that, you know, Cindy, Randall, others that have been here for quite a while, young grasshopper.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and some of it's like, let's not make the same mistake because I've been here and made this mistake where I did something, but I didn't talk to that department and impacted them and like, you know, nobody told us about it, right?
Yeah.
So communication's hard in an organization, so.
It's always hard. That's what I've learned.
Yeah.
Speaking of mistakes, the maddest that Jay has ever been at me.
Oh, come on.
What would you, I remember. You remember?
Is this podcast about you?
It's just the reality of working on a team and how we problem solve. It actually
I can. Do you want me to go into great details and revive that? Do we have somebody here to do a little EMDR with you?
I would
after
like
it's
to
over?
Do some parts work and, you know, an empty chair with you today. We could, you know, we could bring our clinical team in here and show people how we do it. No. I think that it's just kind of now I can smile about it, but it's actually an AV issue.
Yeah.
In a board meeting.
You had taken on a project to redo the auditorium and we had a problem with a situation, and I had actually had board members say, you know, this is really, really bad. And, and you promised me that it would never happen again.
That's what I did.
And then it happened again.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were just casually having a lunch, and you made something that triggered me, and I was not in a spiritually centered place. And I don't know. I don't remember the exact words, but I basically threatened to fire you. And
That's true.
And you were like, you were taken aback. So yeah. I did not, that was not one of my greatest highlight reels as a CEO, but thanks for forever preserving it on YouTube.
I think it just speaks to, like, you did immediately. Like, it wasn't a, you know, it was a...
It was reactionary.
And I've said some things sideways to you, too, which we don't... You know, this is about you, again, not me. And I think that... So one of the other things that I love about you is you have a short memory. People don't know that about you around here if they don't, you know, have the opportunity to work.
It's good in marriage as well.
Seriously, you know, because... Something might happen and we fix a problem and the next day that you come in, and I've seen you do this with the whole team and with Cumberland Heights as a whole, it's a brand new day.
Yeah.
And let's focus on what we need to do today, and you're not going to hold that over somebody for a long period of time.
No, but every now and then I like to drop little things, you know, so that's the dark side of that, as I'll say. Remember when the auditorium, you know,
are
you sure that this will never happen again?
That's right.
But you're right. I don't, you know, there's no point in that. You know, you don't hide things. You need to address them. You need to be open and able to talk about it. And I think we do that. And I do that with others, but again, it's like, you know, can't live in the past. It's like,
so what's interesting about that, Jay, because you're 8 years going on 9 as CEO, you've been here for 30 years as an employee of some kind. So we're talking about, you know, how to kind of resolve conflict with your team in a high intensity moment or whatever it might be. But I guess what I'm curious about is, how has your leadership style changed over the past 8 years in maybe ways that you didn't expect? Because it is tricky. Multiple personalities, different ways of learning.
I've never been diagnosed with multiple personalities.
Different ways to receive feedback.
Yeah. You know, I've got my strengths and I've got my weaknesses. You know, I wouldn't say I've got a huge emotional EQ or whatever. I don't, you know, we did the Enneagram and we've done some of those pieces where, you know, like, this is how somebody likes to hear feedback. I can't remember that. Right. So sometimes I don't always approach people, but I do learn over time that, you know, like, I know you're fairly much a perfectionist. And so I might respond to you different than I would respond to somebody else who might be not as confident in themselves, you know, where I need to tell them that we didn't do this optimally. You know, but I want to make sure that they don't, like, you know, that it doesn't feed that they're quote unquote not good enough, right? Because they are good enough. They wouldn't be on the team if they weren't good enough.
Right, right.
So that's changed. I don't know how my leadership style has changed. And, you know, in some ways I feel like I don't communicate as well as I did early on. And that's because I feel like I'm busier. Yeah. Mm.
Communicate, like, with your immediate team or the Cumberland Heights team?
The whole organization. Mm. The whole organization. This year, you know, what we're trying to do is have these all-staff meetings, different than the old all-staff meetings, but once a month, just be topical, give information, keep it short and interesting, not try to fill an hour. Because as long as I've been here in 30 years, if you ask the employees what are the top three things that are a problem, it's communication. I know that's not unique to Cumberland Heights. It's in other organizations. But, you know, how can we communicate that? And email, there's so much email. Not everybody reads the email. It's kind of boring, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's something that I need to do a better job of. And I'm inviting the team to do that and be topical, you know, about those sort of things.
What, over the past 8 or 9 years, what has happened in your role that you least expected? I guess where I'm going, when I think about what it might be like to be the CEO of a nonprofit organization, it's probably a lot different being in the seat than it is, you know, being a team member that surrounds a leadership team. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is. And sort of how that plays in with how it's changed. You know, early on, we were new, and there'd been a long-time CEO, 20-plus years. So there was a lot of you know, the board wanted to make sure they were doing their due diligence, their governance and all that, make sure there was going on. We had a great board chair, Jay Perkins. He was out there. He was out here every week with me. You know, over time, I think you keep doing the right things. And then, you know, I think the board has trust in me and my leadership team. And that happens over time. So that piece is a little different. You know, so it's going from, and it, we went from just sort of like, you know, stabilizing things to being able to pick up steam and stride. We've done a lot in the last, you know, almost, you know, 9 years in May, so 8 and a half in the organization. You know, we've, and I mean, we've got a lot more IOP locations. Mm-hmm. You know, we, I think I was CFO when we bought Stillwater's women's location, but I was part of the early days of Stillwater's women. We purchased the Arch Academy location for the boys, moved them to their own campus.
In COVID.
During COVID. We went through COVID. So that's a unique experience. Every CEO that I talked to, the COVID, like nobody, they do not teach you in MBA school how to manage an organization during a pandemic. But, you know, we all went through that together. So that's where I think our culture and our team, you know, really paid off during that time. But we, you know, we're about to do an Arch Academy for girls. You know, we've got a lot of things that we're in, you know, a big building campaign too. So that's, so most recently, that's the most different thing. I'm involved with development more than I ever have been. Mm-hmm. Because of that. So,
Can I ask you something controversial? Kind of. It shouldn't be.
Yeah?
I think it was at one point.
Oh, yeah. I know where you're going.
MAT.
MAT. So, medication-assisted therapy. You know, we've been around since 1966. We have a long history of being rooted in 12 steps and 12-step traditions and a spiritual program of recovery. That hasn't changed. But through the years, there are developments, there's science, there's other things that bring to the mix. So we were not an early adopter of using Suboxone, particularly, for anything other than detox from like methadone or hardcore opiates. And it was great for that. It really helped people. A lot of people were in a lot of pain, couldn't get through the detox period. So we saw that early success. And I think, you know, that's... But we went through that process as a team. We did our homework. We interviewed places that had done it. We went to Hazelden. We talked to Ashley Addiction. We talked to some of our friends about how they did it. We spent probably way too much time talking about it as a team, facilitating conversations with stakeholders at a high level. You know, and I think a lot of that was just a fear of like it would change who we are, our DNA, and, you know, and the way that we do MAT to support people in early recovery is not inconsistent with the way that we were treating people before. It's just a new tool. And I do think the organization has to grow and evolve. You know, I think at one time we were afraid of co-occurring disorders in the same way. And saying sort of like, well, we don't do that. We're not dual diagnosis was the term years ago. But the reality is our, you know, when we met and started having more intense talks about that with our clinical directors and the clinical teams, it's like, we're doing this already. We just hadn't embraced it, you know? And so one thing that I like about the integrity of Come On Heights is we don't put a billboard up at a conference that says we do, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, because somebody might be looking for G. So we're kind of slow to kind of claim that. But the reality is, and the data show, you know, from the research center, I forgot to mention the research center is one of the things we did. Sorry about that. That wasn't intentional. No. We're the RCAs. That's another good topic.
Huge, yep.
But we actually do a lot, and then the more we measured it, we saw, you know, this is our patient, and we're making significant progress in their depression, their anxiety, increasing their recovery capital, et cetera, et cetera. And then we became actually more intentional about training on it because of our clinical teams are a great mix of master's level professionals, licensed, you know, clinical social workers, LMFTs, LPCs, LADACs, people with lived recovery. And so how can we give them more skills? So that's part of why we do the events that we do, the trainings that we do, is so that somebody has called us. We don't claim this enough either. We're a learning institution, really. You can come here at post your master's degree and continue to develop your clinical skills. And when we do that for our staff, it helps our patients. And so that's why we do it. It's great for the staff. Don't get me wrong. I love helping the staff to grow and find value in their jobs. But the ultimate payoff is that they are then with patients and they have more skills to help them find their journey of recovery.
Yeah. One thing about MAT, because I had just started when that was heating up for us. So this was 2018. And at the leadership level and some of the director level, just mid organization level, we were talking about, there was just a lot of fear.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fear. And we're both in recovery. And I think that oftentimes there seems to be an exchange, a binary exchange between, you know, celebrating 12-step culture, which we believe in wholeheartedly, the value of the process, not the event of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
The process of showing up early, staying late, sitting close to the front, asking for help is so valuable for a lot of folks, as well as investing in, for those that are appropriate, the current evidence-based tools that are available in the really large field of psychology. And that's what I saw the most from all of us, myself included too. It's mm-hmm. not like I came in and I can't believe we don't do this, but you know, the data are clear, you know, that just, I just want to feel like I want to say this, that, you know, MAT does two things really well, right? It reduces craving and overdose related death.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told this story before, but I remember going to a presentation in graduate school and seeing the deputy director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. I told this with Nikki, actually, Michael Botticelli.
Mm.
And you will not – have I ever told you this story?
Maybe, but, you know, I have a short memory.
You will not find this surprising, but I was in grad school and, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 years of recovery at that time and just sure of how recovery worked, you know. And I remember – you know, there was like the point in the presentation, he was talking about MAT, and there's a point in the presentation where he was asking questions, and I was the first, you know, just, and I just had some, I can't remember exactly what I said, but some offensive question that was inappropriate in terms of, you know, that striking that balance between mm-hmm. the role of evidence-based. And he actually took the time to answer the question, then asked me to stay behind.
Mm.
And I was like ready, you know, to like let this person know with my knowledge. And he just said, you know, it is a tool that we need to embrace from a harm reduction perspective that's different than treatment. So you need to change your perspective to help people stay alive long enough to try to teach them how to live in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And he started talking about his own recovery, and it really just diffused my ego. So, and I appreciate where Cumberland has gone with that, because yeah. I think that our fear – we thought that staff was going to have a big issue. We thought that the stakeholders in our community were going to have a big issue, and we made it maybe more of an issue than we thought it was going to be.
We certainly did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, reflecting on a previous question, I chose not to push that down the team's throat.
Hmm.
My role was to introduce the topic and have us continue to have conversations around that until collectively we came to a conclusion that it had a place and what that would look like for us.
Yeah.
You know, Hazelden had their core 12. You know, what's that going to be for Cumberland Heights? How are we going to do that in an authentic way? But you're right. There were people that, like, we'll lose a third of the staff and all that. I think we had one nurse resign, and she came back later.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and actually, you know, but it was, yeah, you're right. There was like, it'll be in the newspaper, you know, you know, like Cumberland Heights, you know, lets a patient stay on Suboxone, post it, you know,
yeah.
And I knew that at the time. I knew that wasn't going to be the case. That's
right.
But we had to walk through those fears, and, you know, I think our patients are better served by that. And there's other examples of that we've done through time. You know, you know, we've been around for, you know, since 1966 for 57 plus years, I guess 58 this year. You know, so we have a lot of great traditions, but it's also new things. You know, we really want to kick the tires and make sure that they fit really well. So, the stuff that I think we've kept is the good stuff, you know.
Well, this has kind of been a common theme too, which you might dive into as much as you want, but the field changes. So my limited perspective working in the field is there's an ebb and there's a flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see that with equity dollars. You see that just there aren't the same centers here in the Middle Tennessee area that there were just 5 years ago, just 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've talked a lot about, so I'm leading the witness a little bit,
okay,
is the role and the value of nonprofit centers in the addiction treatment space and how they're becoming more of a rare breed,
mm-hmm,
and how that might impact quality of care options in the future.
Yeah, so that's, well, there's a lot to unpack in that. So related back to your question about being a nonprofit, so as a CEO, I'll answer that. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to answer the question you said 10 minutes ago. I don't have to improve the margin quarter over quarter.
Yep.
I don't have that kind of pressure. One of the early things that I learned, and I attribute it to Joe Morgan, because Joe Morgan was here and he's the one I heard it from, but I've heard it attributed to other people as well. He would always say, if you take care of the patient will take care of you. I didn't understand what that meant. But how I see it now serving is like, you know, our best referrants are our alumni. It's the people that came through here whose lives are changed, and then they have a family member or their neighbor that comes up to them or somebody at work and says, you know, hey, John, I know you used to drink as bad as I do, but, you know, you seem to have gotten your act together. What happened? You know, because we took care of John, you know, John shares his experience with somebody else that takes care of us, and it sort of creates the next admission that comes along. So there's that. From an industry standpoint, I used to call it a pendulum, you know, because it does swing to extremes and then it tends to get back to center. But the landscape of treatment was more a lot of small, mission-driven providers. Some of those were people that started their treatment center because they had a passion for it. They usually were in recovery.
Right.
They didn't get rich from it. The successful ones, you know, probably got their money back, but there was times that they were worried about, you know, will we be here? You know, how do I make payroll next month?
Right.
You know, insurance came along. There were abuses in the insurance in the 80s that led to managed care in the 90s. And then that was a hard time, and that weaned a bunch of people out in the 90s because, I mean, you know, even us, it was pretty dramatic when we went from everybody getting 28 days covered by the insurance company to, you know, an insurance company saying, you know, he's been there 5 days, he's ready to go. So, which is why our IOP exploded, our treatment delivery exploded. We had to be better at variable length of stay and individualized treatment plans and that sort of thing. In the current environment, more recently, there's a lot of people that think that, like, this is a big profit center. So there's a lot of private equity money going into either consolidating or starting de novo projects. To some degree, there might be oversaturation, over competition for certain markets and all of that. And so what happens is if, as a nonprofit, if you're not watching your bottom line, then you put yourself at risk of not being able to fulfill your mission. So that's where I think that my finance background, you know, it's not about the money, but without the money that we don't have the mission, the old thing, you know, no margin, no mission. So I think that we as an organization are really good about being good stewards of the profits, setting some aside for a rainy day, investing in capital that we're going to need to do in the future, trying to, you know, all along while trying to take care of our employees and our patients along the way. I mean, we had New York strip steak for lunch today. So I could have, you know, I could have gone to the kitchen and said, you know, hamburger would be just fine. We do have hamburgers, but you know what I'm saying? You can cut a lot out. And so I think what I see in the PE space is a lot of times they're not necessarily in it for the long haul. They are looking for return on investment. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America. This is capitalism, all that. But where sometimes that doesn't do well is like if you're about to sell your facility for some multiple of EBITDA, earnings before interest, depreciation, and amortization, for those who didn't go to a business school, you want to squeeze all that down as much as you can, because you're going to get, you know, even a $25,000 cost, if you're going to get 10 times EBITDA, becomes another $250,000 you get when you sell. That can be inconsistent with quality care. Two-thirds of our cost are people. And so people tend to go, and then you have larger group sizes, and all the patient experience can suffer.
And what you're not saying, which I agree with you, is that treatment centers that are owned by an equity group or by a large healthcare corporation, you can go to those places and get great treatment. Life-saving treatment. We have many peer organizations that we believe in, that we partner with on all levels of the organization. But you were right that oftentimes this business isn't people generally, in my opinion, not the official opinion of Cumberland Heights Foundation and the institution I'm associated with, don't get into this field to make a huge margin, to your point. And there's not the same ratio of net income that maybe an equity fund is used to, right, in other domains of business in this country. And so I think sometimes, because I've been a part, I've worked at a center, which you know, which doesn't matter who it was, but I've worked at a center that was purchased by an equity fund and strung together with lots of different organizations. And my experience was is that we were stripped of the most the highest expense in the organization, which was FTEs, to the bare minimum.
Right.
And that's because it's because we had a shared EBITDA across all the organizations and we had to maintain that margin.
Yeah.
And so unfortunately that's not in the best interest of patient care, like you said, for, you know, the ratio of staff that we have when you walk around a campus like this or Arch Academy or Stillwaters, how many people are available? You know, is it the state minimum or is it actually extra? Both. Because it's not just – our customers aren't just our patients. It's also our staff, you know, and we want to make sure that our staff are happy, healthy, and whole and enjoy the work that they do and don't feel resentful at the CEO, right, or at their team members or at their boss or at the patients.
Yeah.
So, no, I appreciate your insight there. I wanted you to share about that because I think it's important for people to recognize, you know, maybe there's a lot of popular culture that supports this idea that there's – you know, money-hungry institutions that are here to take advantage of patients, and that is not the case.
Yeah, so it's like a lot of things, you know. We've got, and we have people, there's also another, we talked about sort of PE.
Yeah.
And then we talked about nonprofit, but there's also a lot of people that are founder-owned, mm-hmm. you know, and they, a lot of them do good treatment. You know, what I get concerned about is like, when they're ready to retire, unless their kids love that mission, you know, because it's family owned, how does that get passed on? And so sometimes that goes for away with the second generation, but then it becomes more and more people. So the easiest thing to do is to go to somebody that's well funded, like PE, and sell.
Yeah.
So that has been a shift, consolidation in the industry. So there's efficiencies that can be gained from, you know, taking 10 centers with 50 places to have it, you know, to scale that up and all that. But it's important, you know, you got to take care of the patient first. So I think those that can do both, gain efficiencies, but take and provide great quality care, they'll survive, you know, and they will be strong competitors, stronger for us. They have deep access to capital. You know, we have to raise money for the new buildings we're going to put up. They just go to the market, and it's like we make a decision. They borrow the money, you know. So that is a challenge for people like us. But But again, I think it comes down to taking care of the patient. And we talk about patients a lot, but I'm reminded that our patients are people's brothers, dads, sons, mothers, sisters, grandmothers. And it's not just them, it's their family. You know, we treat the family as well. So what I see, and sometimes that gets shortcutted. I had a conversation with somebody that used to be a spiritual care chaplain at a large organization, and I asked them, like, how many chaplains or pastoral counselors did you have? She said, at one time we had 8 plus interns, and when I left, we had 2. Well, when I started at Cumberland Heights, we had 1, and now we have 2. We're not anywhere as big as this other organization, but that's sort of an expense item. Like, well, does that generate any revenue? Well, no. But for somebody who needs that spiritual care, that needs help and understanding, or dealing maybe with some scars and some damage of the past related to that, those people are absolutely vital to the work that we do. And they're part of that team that we've put together over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it matters for the people that are starting in an IOP today, or parents or guardians that are driving an adolescent to Arch Academy, which would be a nerve-wracking experience for anybody, or somebody driving under the arch and going to admit, you know, into this facility today and have missed the New York steak for lunch, which will probably swing back around in 14 days or so. I want to switch gears, and I want to talk to you about NAATP.
Okay.
The National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. And before I kind of tee that up for you, we had Walt Quinn here record an episode, which will be going out in this season, maybe a month from now. And of course, we love Walt and his history and experience with Cumberland Heights. We had a fun time with Walt. He lost his keys at one point. It was a whole adventure, but just can't say enough about him. But he spoke actually a lot about the concert series and the growth of that, of course, but also business development and the growth of maybe the Cumberland Heights brand nationally and being a part of organizations like NAATP by way of helping us advocate for our services on a national level. So you are, congratulations, the new board chair of the National Association. And I just wanted you to speak to that a little bit and talk about maybe your history and what that means.
Well, first, let me just say that Walt Quinn is one of the most beloved people in the treatment industry, and that just speaks to his character as to who he is and who he was, and always willing to spend time with a newcomer in the business. And it was great that I had an opportunity to work with Walt. Walt was important in expanding our brand during his time here, and probably going back to, like the early 2000s, we started to get involved with the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. And that got us more recognized at a national level. A lot of people would come here and say, like, you know, you guys are great. Why did I not know you were here? So we were like the best little hidden secret in the Southeast or something. We were very much a regional provider, and that's fine. We still treat a lot of people out of this region, mainly out of this region. But a lot of those people, when they had a loved one that needed help, they'd pick up the phone and call my predecessor or Walt and somebody and say, hey, my brother needs help, and they'd send them here. So we had that grassroots kind of known for the quality of care that we did, but we weren't known as to who we were. And I think NAATP helped put us on that stage and be amongst our peers during that time period. And you mentioned the concert series. You know, the concert series, John Hyatt's involvement with Come On Heights, all of that has been a great fundraiser, but it also really connects us with Nashville. When people think of Nashville, they think of music and the music industry, and we treat a lot of musicians. We've treated a lot of musicians. We've worked with Music Cares. And, you know, one of the things I'm proud about is you don't read about those people on some tabloid or people cover, you know, so-and-so's at Cumberland Heights. You know, so we're able to maintain that anonymity really, really well. I think that helped get us some recognition outside of Nashville, Middle Tennessee, and that sort of thing. My own personal involvement with NAATP really began, you know, I actually was sort of kept in the basement, so to speak, you know, and literally for a long, long time. So when people, I'd meet people at it, when I got, came in my new roles, they're like, oh, you're the new CEO. And like, you know, how long have you been at Cummins Watson? Like 30 years or, you know, at the time, 22.
Yeah.
Well, where have you been? And I'd say I was in the basement, you know, so, but I didn't go to conferences. I didn't go to marketing, you know, sort of things like that. But they knew our reputation. They would share all that. And I was there to assure them that we're the same place that we've always been. That's sort of thing. I remember John Driscoll, who was with Hazel and Betty Ford at the time, was a board member when I first came onto the board of NAATP. He was the treasurer, and with my finance background, he wanted me to be on the finance committee. And I said, I'll serve, but what I'm really concerned about is ethics, because ethics was the biggest issue in our industry, and it continues to have. It's gotten better in some ways, but there's still problems in that area. And so I was really involved with NAATP. And it's sort of a similar story. That's where I got noticed at NAATP, because here's this new board member that's in his second or third year. And I think by the third year, I was chairing the ethics committee. And we were doing a lot at NAATP at that time and getting noticed at a national level, trying to clean things up and help the industry.
And you had a big hand in sort of the committee and the rest of the board at that time, which 2015-ish, in rewriting the ethics code for the trade organ. And just for people that don't know, NAATP, the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers, is one of our largest trade organizations in support of addiction treatment, specifically for C-suite level leaders that work for programs that mm-hmm. support people with substance use disorder. So it was a big, and there was a lot of turbulence associated with that you could share if you want. But one thing I was hoping you'd talk about too is just the challenges that we had then and maybe still today with marketing.
So it was the wild, you know, you hear people talk about the Wild West, and so it was the Wild West. There was a lot of a lot of unscrupulous things going on. I mean, flat out fraud and deception, and a lot of dollars going into that. Horrific things being done. You know, some things, if you've never been aware of it, but, you know, people would literally get somebody that had just gotten out of treatment, meet them at a meeting, induce them to relapse, pay them cash, give them drugs to get them readmitted into another treatment center. I mean, patient brokering. That's, you know, people paying people for
admissions.
Admissions. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, Nick, in January when I was interim CEO, I got a phone call from somebody in Florida, and thank God I can't remember who it was, and they said, you know, hey, Jay, love, you know, what you do up there, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're an out-of-network provider. You know, I'll give you 3 in-network admissions if you give me 1 really good out-of-network. And I was like, you know, I didn't even know what he was talking about. And I said, but we don't do that here. We refer patients because we think it's the best quality care for them. We don't do any quid pro quo type arrangements. But that was rampant. People posing as Alcoholics Anonymous with websites to generate traffic, people having our name and image and all of that in order to trick people into think that they were coming to the Cumberland Heights. So that got the attention, got Google's attention. They brought in legit scripts to try to clean that up. It got better for a while, but there's still kind of workarounds, I mean, you know, so... and ethics codes have been written in the state of Florida. There's people that have gone to jail, gone to prison, that sort of thing. Congress actually appropriated money for the FTC to investigate, you know, these sort of things because it was such an issue. And it's gotten better, but it's not totally gone away. You know, what we see now, probably the biggest abuse is people use their phone a lot to search for treatment. There's only so much real estate on your phone. And so what a lot of people don't know is that search, the first few are usually paid ads. And they can present as if they're looking like they're Cumberland Heights. People call. And then they may say, well, I'm looking at your record, and it seems like you've been to Cumberland Heights. You really need to go to one of our sister facilities in, you know, Malibu or wherever. And inducing them to go with free plane tickets and other sort of things like that. But they're lying to people too from the get go. And so, you know, I posit that anybody that's willing to do that unethical behavior in order to get a patient into treatment is probably not providing quality treatment when they're there. And disproportionately, these what I call bad actors, you know, they'll have so much of the dollars going into getting somebody admitted and to profits that not enough is going into clinical care. So
yeah, it is still a problem. And yeah, it's there's light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, without getting into too many details about, you know, ongoing this, that, or the other that we're doing here. But I think part of it that's kind of interesting, just, you know, technology is always evolving, mm-hmm, you know, and for an organization like ours, you know, we're not, you know, we don't have the biggest technology teams or the biggest marketing teams, mm-hmm, or a big war chest of dollars that we can throw at traditional or digital advertisements and hiring, you know, I don't know, big marketing vendors that are in the details of how the algorithms change all the time.
Right. And
I think that's really what we see today is just a manipulation of the rules, for certainly the policies, and sometimes most recently law of misrepresenting and misguiding patients to being able to make an informed treatment decision, which, like you said, is just abhorrent, you know, and not okay, just in terms of people that might be searching for a fellowship hall or a Karen or a Hazelden, yeah, or some place in between, you know. It would be, just as a side, a small example, and then I want to ask you something else, but, it, you know, if somebody was looking for cancer treatment, MD Anderson, and mm-hmm, they ended up somewhere else because they clicked a link that looked like MD, I mean, that would be, we wouldn't stand for it.
We wouldn't stand for
it. Yeah, we wouldn't stand for it. So what's your favorite part of your job?
Visioning. Yeah. Where do we go from here? Mm. What do we do next? Trying to, you know, go from good to great, mm-hmm, you know. We do a lot of things really, really well, but there's always something that we could do better, you, yeah, know. So I guess if there's a criticism to me, is I'm and you know this, as a, I'm a kind of a critical grader, right? And so I probably don't. I don't always give enough of the praise for this was great, this was great, this was great, this was great, but this needs improvement. And, you know, and I know you as a person, like, even if I did it that way, the only thing you would hear is like, this needs improvement.
Well,
yeah, we're working on that.
I think we're similar in that way, that when I see something, it's not, it's, as there are some team members here that their annual evaluation is coming up, but, like, you know, I think I'm always looking at, and you seem to always be looking at things through the eye of not necessarily how we made a mistake and how awful that is, but like where we could be.
Yeah.
You know,
what can we learn from that?
And yeah, what can we learn from it, and how we can be better, and how we can touch more lives and give more resources to a patient to be as successful as possible. Because I got to tell you, I went to Crossover. I told you this the other, yeah, day. I went to Crossover for the first time in several years. Part of that's probably because of COVID. Another part of that's probably just because I work here and, mm-hmm, I try to go to meetings that aren't really, you know, work connected. And it was a beautiful thing. I didn't know what to expect after COVID, you know, because we Crossover just changed for a little bit with COVID and specifically this residential site. But, you know, it was like standing room only, mm-hmm, you know, with 30 alumni. I don't know if that's a violation of policy these days, but quite a few alumni. And, you know, the auditorium was full of patients and the breakout meetings were just as I remember.
Yeah.
You know, 13 years ago as a patient here. And
how about homecoming?
Homecoming was cool too. Homecoming was really cool. Shout out to the marketing team and Stacy Bridges.
What was homecoming? Stacy Bridges, yes, great. What was homecoming? What was homecoming?
Homecoming was an idea that somebody had at Cumberland Heights. The debate is on about where that idea came from. But the idea was to celebrate Okay, one of the things that's unique about Cumberland that I learned when I came, because I was a patient here too, but you know, I wasn't associate for, I lived in a different state for years and years, and then I got, you know, dragged back here to be an employee by you. And one of the things that I noticed is there's so many people that work in addiction treatment that have been touched by Cumberland Heights, certainly with this in this region. I mean, yeah. I have so many friends that got their first job in recovery here and have gone on to do really incredible things, which we always try to fan that flame as much as we can. And so there was an idea that was born actually with, we were having lunch with
Josh or
Jamie Vance, and kind of thought about just creating a celebration for those that had worked here for a time.
Yeah.
And we never really had a structured celebration geared specifically to them. And we just thought, what a miss.
Yeah, we'd have the going away party and say, don't be a stranger, come back for lunch, whatever. And then there's just like, when do you just sort of drive out and, you know, or call up and say, hey, put my name at the Welcome Center because I want to come visit. So we created an event for that.
Yeah, which was
amazing.
It was really cool.
And what was special for me about that, because that was the question you were going to ask me, is how many people who had long, you know, some of these people are retired or at the end of their careers, or they've gone on and, you know, they've grown. But how meaningful the time that they had here in their career, either the most meaningful work of all their professional career or the connections and the value and the love that they still had for this organization, for this place, you know, and how they carried that with them. I mean, we had people come from out of state to do this. It was sort of the first thing that we ever had, and it was emotional, you know, and a few of those.
It was healing.
And it was healing, because a few of those didn't end necessarily well. Like, we were at a point where, okay, you know, we need to go our separate ways. And, you know, and then they were back, and they were welcome. And, you know, we had not been intentional about that. So I hope we are doing that again this year. I think it was an amazing event. I think it could, there was probably other people that we didn't know where they were. We would love for them to come. If you're watching the podcast, you can email Nick today. And
specifically, Kathy Knox, who's an oversight and a mistake, and we love you.
I love Kathy Knox.
We love Kathy Knox.
Yeah. I've got a lot of Kathy Knox stories, but yeah, so that was a great thing. And, you know, and for me, it's also, you know, I sometimes can be paternalistic and like, they left us, they left me. I've seen other, Heath is the worst at this right now. You know, if anybody leaves,
Heath under the bus with
if somebody leaves him, it's like, you know, dang that, whatever. Because that sense of loyalty, and I brought you up from a pup and all that stuff. Well, what I saw is the pups, you know, were champion dogs, you know, in other organizations, and they had an opportunity. And
that's
so
right.
The time here was valuable, and they're still friends of Cumberland Heights. They refer family here. They refer other people here. So to embrace that and have a better opportunity, we do the alumni homecoming, but this was different. It was for people that worked here.
And yeah, thank you, Stacy. I mean, she did such an amazing job.
Well, Stacy's here. I didn't know you were in the room.
Trying to balance everything. One of the things you've taught me, and I just want to say out loud, is, you know, we're all for those of us that are here, quote unquote, working at Cumberland Heights today, we're all temporary proprietors of the mission. You know, we have our time, and that time inevitably will end for every single one of us. And the homecoming event for me was just a grateful time to be up, just to think, guess it's cool to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, for the folks that have gone on that are still working at other providers or that are retired or working in a whole other field, it is special. There's something special about working and being a part of the mission and serving other people, oftentimes who end up working here, that are in recovery. The last thing that I want to say about you, because part of inviting you on here, being a CEO is not an easy job. So I think that part of our focus of wanting you to be here, you know, is there's many different domains of focus there, but to humanize that role a little bit and also just to recognize that like any other role, it has its challenges, it has its strengths, and it's not all about, and you do this well, it's not all about, you know, greeting visitors and shaking hands. You know, in fact, that has very little to do with the role day to day. And it can be a challenge, especially to manage people with a lot of personalities and telling them no. And but one of the things that I love about Jay, the story that I was saving for the end, which I could go a lot of different directions here, my friend.
I don't know where you're going.
But I think in COVID, 2020 or 2021, my times are that it feels like a decade, but so I'll be a little blurry. You probably won't like that I'll tell this story, but I remember being in leadership, be all right, one day, or maybe we were meeting individually, and anyways, you presented an idea, and it was your idea.
Thank you for giving me credit for one of my ideas.
Was that I think at this point of the year, we had made, you know, net income $500,000.
Not in 2020.
So maybe it was 2021. And you were really concerned about the frontline staff and those maybe in the organization that inflation was kicking off at that time, which still is. We're still recovering from that, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. This isn't an economics course today, but CNBC, as you like to observe. But Jay came to the team and said that he wanted to spend a majority of that revenue to give people a mid-year bonus. And it's not something we sent an email about, or it's not something we made a video on, but it really made an impact on me in a way that I think was special, because I certainly, to be honest, I was thinking about, I don't know, fiber and QM and research and some, you know, crazy deadline that my boss had given me. And I'm sure everybody else on the team was not thinking about the dishwasher or the person on maintenance staff or one of our RAs and our CAs. And so we did that. Mm-hmm. You did that. And that was because of you and your leadership. And so it's something that I just wanted to say thanks for being that person for Cumberland Heights and that temporary proprietor that I think really cares about every person that works here and every patient and family that gets affected by Cumberland. I love you, man.
I love you too. So the mid-year bonus, yeah. So what I'll say is that we had to go to the board and make that case, but by then I had trust, right? And they could have said, that doesn't seem very prudent right now, but they didn't. And so the board, you know, because I answer, you've got one boss that can be very particular. I've got 25. So, but they were all in because, you know, we can't take care of the patients unless we've got the right staff, good staff. And you alluded to this. I think working in the homecoming, it's a calling for many people, not everybody. Some people are here, they're going to do their job, get a paycheck, go. They won't be here for 2 or 3 years. The people that choose to stay here, they're called by the work that we do, and it is meaningful. It absolutely changes lives. It changed your life. It changed my life. You know, our parents are so grateful for this place. Society should be very grateful for this place because we would be causing havoc somewhere or be dead, you know. So, So I'm humbled and honored to be the CEO. You know, to think that a person that sat in the group room chair in 1989 is the CEO of this place is a miracle. And really, a lot of my best ideas, I will say, are God-inspired. There's a bunch of them that just come to me. There are too many coincidences. There's the whole Arch Academy story, which you know well. There's the story of Sean Harrell becoming the recovery coach, where it just came to me and I called Heath, and like how I thought of his, you know, it. I believe my role is to be an instrument, and I have a job to do just like everybody else here. My job's different than the counselor's job or the nurse's job or the dishwasher's job. But everybody here is important for the patient to get in recovery. Everybody is important. I do not do one group therapy session. I never do an individual session. But people's lives are absolutely getting transformed, changed, because they came to Cumberland Heights. I get to be a part of that as my life's work. What a blessing.
What an honor. Yeah. What an honor. Absolutely. Well, thank you for stopping by. We appreciate it. We appreciate your time. We appreciate the support, because this was kind of an interesting, we've been doing this show for now a year, whatever, 9 months, almost a year. And you gave us a little latitude to make something like this come to fruition. And I think it's been worth it. So we appreciate that. Yeah.
You guys have done a great job. You got a good team that you've assembled here.
We've got a great team.
We could do a whole nother podcast on things that I think are my idea and that you think are your idea.
We could.
Or things that, like, putting Barnwood on the door and not asking me permission, because you know I probably would have said no, and just doing it, you know? So, and most of those have been successful for
most
you.
Of the,
but we could do an episode. Times,
yeah, on, we could do the ones that haven't been successful. But yeah, no. But thanks again, and we'll absolutely have you on here again. And for those that are listening, like our channel, our social media channels, you'll see them down in the corner. They'll pop up. We appreciate y'all. We appreciate the support. And we'll see you next time.